You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the hours, days, weeks, and months after the terrorist attacks 11 years ago today, hard decisions were made regarding how to protect our country and our way of life. Some were assumed at the time to be temporary, while others were intended to be more permanent. And yet, few could have known how much the decisions made in that first year and a half following the attacks would be, for better or worse, shaping the world, our nation, and the daily lives of every American. In his latest book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, Kurt Eichenwald, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair, focuses on the difficult decisions facing the Bush administration and how policies, not, as it turns out, all in the country's best interests, were pushed through and sneaked past Congress and the American people. It's published by Touchstone. I'm very pleased to welcome Kurt Eichenwald back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
You have an op-ed piece in today's New York Times in which you reveal a number of previously unreported warnings that the Bush administration received about an imminent al-Qaeda attack. Do we know how many warnings President Bush himself received in the months between his inauguration and September 11, 2001?
During that time, he received 70 separate briefings on al-Qaeda. I have not seen all 70. And the ones that I have seen are all dealing very specifically with there's an attack coming.
Well, the Bush administration refused to declassify many of these briefings, pretty much all but one. How were you able to gain access to even the ones that you saw?
Now, you don't really think I'm going to answer that, do you?
Okay, so this is not a FOIA thing. I'm going to let Kurt see this thing?
There were some, as I mentioned in the piece, there were some declassified documents that I used in this.
Now, why weren't these warnings considered serious enough for President Bush to take action?
Well, there are a lot of things that I think, you know, people jump on a quick bandwagon depending on their political position. One of them is, well, obviously Bush knew and he should have done X. And the other side of it is, well, why can you say this? It's really Clinton's fault. And, you know, it's one of these things. It's just the hyper-politicization of America. What you had, in my opinion, what you had was a circumstance where the Republicans had been out of office for 8 years. When they left, the whole national security apparatus was built around the concept of nation states. Al-Qaeda developed during the Clinton administration, and the concept of non-state threats to national security developed over that time. When the Bush administration came in, they were not, understandably, they were not prepared yet to say, let's shift our entire mindset of how national security issues work. And so that's why, you know, as you were going forward, the CIA would come in and say, you know, bin Laden, and you know, mentioned in the op-ed piece today, the Pentagon would say, no, Iraq.
And you say also the neoconservatives who had been brought into the administration said the CIA had been fooled.
Yes.
In your book, you portray Attorney General John Ashcroft as particularly uninterested in hearing about the al-Qaeda threat. Why was he so indifferent to these obvious warnings?
I think part of it was there were a lot of them coming. And, you know, if you think about it, there were a lot of them coming because there was about to be an attack. And this was the Bush administration's first experience. And so the scene...
Tina Brown pays attention to buzz. George Bush doesn't.
That's true. The scene in there that's most compelling to me is when one of Ashcroft's briefers goes to another room and says, he told me he doesn't want to hear about al-Qaeda anymore. Now, there's been testimony by that individual that he had this experience with Ashcroft. Ashcroft sort of denied it. I mean, when you actually read what he said, it's not a denial. But that's why I found this other thing more compelling, is that there is somebody that the briefer was the acting director of the FBI came to immediately afterwards and said, this is what happened. And so you now have two people saying what had happened at that moment. But Ashcroft just didn't take it seriously.
So on 9/11, they couldn't have been too surprised because whether they had believed the warnings or not, they had heard them.
They had heard them, and I think that's part of the terror that descended on them was that suddenly
it
was real.
Up.
Suddenly it was real. I mean, one of the most, I think, horrifying documents, that has, I think, ever existed is Ashcroft, not even basically, Ashcroft cut the budget for counterterrorism activities during the summer. And the people in the FBI went back and said, look, we'll give up, you know, five or six things, just increase our counterterrorism budget. And he sent a letter out. Ashcroft sent a letter out on September 10th, which was delivered on September 12th, saying, I don't see why this is important and I'm not increasing your budget. So it's one of those horrific documents that will go down in history.
What are some of the most widely held beliefs taken as fact on the day of the attacks that later proved to be false?
Well, on the day of the attacks, there weren't beliefs of, you know, there were confusion. There was, this plane is coming in. I mean, there's something in 500 Days where I talk about how they believed a Northwest airline was coming in, and they actually found that it wasn't by going online and finding that the plane didn't exist. But it was in the aftermath of 9/11 when a series of things that many people still think are true. I mean, my favorite example, there was the Al-Qaeda training manual, which, you know, anybody paying attention has heard about, which was the basis of a lot of policy. It was a basis of policy at Guantanamo. It was the basis of policy in terms of interrogation activities. And the most shocking thing in my mind, there are a lot of shocking things in 500 days, but the most shocking thing in my mind was finding out that this Al-Qaeda training manual, in fact, was not an Al-Qaeda training manual. It had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. And it
was. Whose training manual was it?
It was, well, there's actually the longest end note I've ever written in my life is at the end of the book where I start laying out all of the evidence. And in the end, it is the training manual of a small, relatively incompetent jihadist group from about 1992. And their entire effort was to overthrow the government of Egypt, which had nothing to, is the opposite of what Al-Qaeda wanted to do. And so, you know, I'm sure people will remember, I hope, will remember hearing that, well, this manual tells them to come out and lie about torture. And so when they're saying they're being tortured, they're just following the Al-Qaeda training manual. Well, in fact, what they were talking about in this document was not lying. We're talking about people who were arrested in Egypt under suspicion of terrorism. They would be tortured. And the point was, when you go into court, reveal that you've been tortured, because then the judge will protect you. So it's again, it's the opposite of what people said.
And nobody would have assumed that Americans would have engaged in torture, at least at that time.
No.
Given the chaotic circumstances of the day and the fact that the president was away from the White House, who in the Bush administration appeared to have the coolest head? Who was actually in charge?
Well, Bush was actually in charge because they maintained a lot of contact. Number two there was Cheney. And Cheney was extremely decisive, sometimes on a level that was, you know, a little bit dangerous. You know, he did get Bush's authorization to allow for a commercial airliner to be shot out of the sky. And he gave out the order and people heard it and said, are you sure?
Were we to shooting down a commercial airliner?
Well, this would have been the plane that crashed in Pennsylvania.
Ah.
And so, you know, it was a real hijacked airline. They had dispatched the fighter the fighters, but there was nothing to shoot down. And, you know, people react with I think it's one of the conceits here that people look at the decisions that were made and they look at, you know, my God, they were going to shoot a commercial airliner out of the sky. And when you actually put yourself in that frame of mind, put yourself in that circumstance, and that's one of the things with 500 Days that I did was write it in a narrative format as things happened so that I can't, you know, no one can go back and say, oh, well, here's what I think. It's like, this is what happened. And when you see what happened, you recognize that any honest reader will recognize that making a call as to whether to shoot an airliner out of the sky was not, you know, an obvious answer.
My guest is Kurt Eichenwald, who's written a book called 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. It's published by Touchstone. Well, you kind of, what you've just said, you say in your introduction, readers looking in these pages for my view of these events will no doubt be disappointed. I have little faith in opinion, even my own. You're saying that, but at the same time, most readers will come away saying they screwed up.
Oh, people will come away saying, you know, I always consider my job to be, you know, I'm like the person who fetches the water. I go out and I get the facts and I get as many as I can. I take years doing it. And then I come back and I give them to the reader. And at that point, it's the reader knows everything I know. Why do they need me to tell them what to think? And so, you know, people will, and I found this in almost every one of my earlier books, is that people will come to me and say, oh, well, you were saying this. And people will come to me and say the exact opposite. You know, one will say I was saying this, the other will say I was saying that. And so people will bring to it whatever they bring to it. I hope what they bring to it is intellectual honesty and the ability to just read and find out what happened.
What countries were the most helpful in the hours and days after the attacks in terms of gathering and passing along intelligence on the hijackers and their plot?
It's an interesting assortment. You had, you know, you clearly had the British. You clearly, the Russians were enormously helpful. The Pakistanis were helpful. The Libyans actually had the most secretive arrangement, but they were turning over phone numbers and they had a lot of material on Al-Qaeda and the terrorist groups, and they turned it over.
You report on a fascinating meeting involving members of American intelligence and diplomatic officials and people from Libya that took place on October 2001 in the London home of Prince Bandar, the Saudi royal family, the longtime ambassador to the United States. Was, before we get to Libyans, was any mention made of the fact that 15 of the 19 9/11 hijackers were citizens of Saudi Arabia?
Oh, that was it's one of these little delicious moments. The representative from Libya and the fellow who was there from the United States was Ben Bonk, who was the number two in the counterterrorist center at the CIA. And they are like, they go into a little room private by themselves. And the Libyan fellow says, well, you know what your real problem is? It's the Saudis. And Bonk is sitting there thinking, we're in the home of the Saudi ambassador. I know it's wired. I'm not saying anything. And so he just stares at the Libyan and changes the subject and moves on. But everybody knew. Everybody knew it was, you know, that the fundamentalism practiced in Saudi Arabia,
Wahhabism,
was really a significant element of the danger from the Islamists.
But was the Saudi family, a royal family, being blamed in any way? After all, they were allies of the United States.
The family was not. Not by the government. You know, they were not being held up as, you know, model citizens. But the relationship with the Saudis was a very complex one. And, you know, at that point, we needed every ally we could get.
Can you talk about the list of phone numbers that the Libyan official handed over to the CIA? And there's a shocking phone number on that list.
Yeah, it's again, it's one of those like delicious moments. It's a pile of, you know, it's just a huge printout of phone numbers, phone numbers, what they call bad numbers that Al-Qaeda people used, and then the numbers that they placed calls to or the numbers that received calls. And Ben Bonk, the CIA fellow, is sitting there flipping through it and looking at the various numbers, and he sees one, which 202 area code. Well, that's Washington, and the prefix was 456. Well, that's the White House. And there was this sudden horror moment on his part that, my God, is there an Al-Qaeda plant in the White House? Now, it ends up it was somebody working at the NSA who had connections in Afghanistan and was making calls to Afghanistan that people knew about. But it really was one of those moments. Bonk looked at that and, you know, in his mind, it was like, look how easy it is to reach a conclusion that somebody is tied up with Al-Qaeda, because here is somebody we know. But what if it wasn't somebody we knew? What if it was just some fellow?
Well, anything was possible, and a mole in the White House could have been possible.
Mole in the White House
well.
Could have been possible.
My guest is Kurt Eichenwald, who is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Conspiracy of Fools and The Informant. His latest is 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. It's published by Touchstone. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Kurt Eichenwald. His latest book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars, published by Touchstone. Weren't steps taken to reach out to countries that we had strained relations with, like Iran in the days after 9/11? What were they hoping to achieve by doing that?
Well, what you had was a circumstance where everybody had the opportunity to be our friend. And there was no concept of, well, that group is off the table because of whatever happened in the past. And one of the things somebody told, I don't remember which country it was, but, you know, there was the past and there is now. And now is we start over. And we got one of the things the book discloses, the magnitude of the cooperation we received from Syria. And Syria was basically doing whatever the United States wanted in this desperate attempt to fix our relationship, but we kind of blew it.
Well, there's also Middle Eastern politics, and Syria may not feel as kindly towards Saudi Arabia, for example.
Right.
Because of tensions between those countries. And then there was the whole matter of gathering people around us. Everybody seemed to have... there seemed to be a sincere outpouring of grief and sympathy from other countries. But then there was the attempt to create a coalition, and then that led to all sorts of tensions, including a lot of anger toward the French.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is in again, one of the more fascinating developments was, you know, really for me, being able to dig into the whole effort to bring the European nations into the Iraqi coalition, the coalition going into the Iraq War.
Called Operation Enduring Freedom.
Yeah, I always love those names. But you know, the book lays out a lot of detail about the whole interaction between Tony Blair and Bush. And it's very different from what we've, you know, heard in the past. In fact, Blair is trying very hard to, you know, guide Bush, to keep him under control. Is having sort of modest success. Blair is lobbying the Russians, and there's a scene in there with Blair talking to Putin, and Putin just saying, basically, your intelligence is garbage. And the more interesting...
You mean about Iraq having a
connection? About Iraq having weapons of mass destruction. The more interesting conversation was between George Bush and Jacques Chirac of France, where Bush is trying every which way to try and persuade Chirac to get the French to participate, and it's not working. And finally, he says, well, you know, Jacques, you know, you're Catholic, I'm Methodist, but we both believe, you know, in the same Lord. And Gog and Magog is coming to pass, and this confrontation is willed by God. And Chirac is hearing this, and it's, you know, his mind says, what what in the world am I hearing? He got off the phone, and it's like, does anybody understand what he was talking about with this Gog and Magog thing? And they actually went and got a biblical expert to have them translate basically what the president of the United States was saying, and it ends up it's something out of the book of Ezekiel and the book of Revelation, but it's an apocalyptic thing. We are, you know, heading towards the apocalyptic battle between good and evil. And at that point, once Chirac heard this, that was it. There was no way France was going to participate.
And that's how we wound up with Freedom Prize. a listener asks, what do you think of the conspiracy theory that the Bush administration wanted an attack of some sort to occur in order to justify a war with Iraq?
I think it's absurd. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the folks who buy into that, they're called the truthers. And I think the truthers are the left version of the birthers, the people who say that Obama, you know, was born in Kenya. At least that's what I've heard. People in Washington can't conspire to have lunch. The idea that such a massive conspiracy could take place is not only absurd, but it's also an outrageous claim. I mean, it's really quite off the charts in terms of its despicability.
A listener, Jim, asks, would you please clarify the record on the Clinton administration's decision not to assassinate bin Laden prior to 9/11? And what was the nature of their advice to the Bush administration regarding the possible threat that al-Qaeda posed?
It's interesting because Clinton believed he had authorized for bin Laden to be killed. The CIA believed that they had not been authorized. And in truth, there was a real – it was very much mishandled by the Clinton White House. If they wanted to have an assassination, they should have done it. And there was a point where they had a not the ones that people talk about, the opportunity to get bin Laden. There are absurd ones that aren't real. But there was a real one where they were putting together a real, you know, commando force of people in Afghanistan who were going to be able to, you know, greatest opportunity we had to take out bin Laden pre 9/11. And the people in the CIA and the NSA were NSC were waiting, National Security Council were waiting for the order. Let's go. We're all set. And the order never came. So, you know, that was where Clinton really fell down. It was in the authorization.
Well, there were some half-hearted attempts. There were a couple of missile attempts, including one in Sudan.
You know, it's sort of like if you throw a dart in the dark, maybe you'll hit something. I mean, you know, this really needed to be a targeted effort. And to the second part of the caller's question, the Bush administration was told very, very strongly that, you know, Sandy Berger from the Clinton administration told Condoleezza Rice, the thing you will be dealing with the most in this administration is Osama bin Laden. And, you know, obviously that proved to be true.
Although, as we pointed out at the beginning of this interview, they just discounted it. Almost everybody in the Bush administration seemed to discount it for one reason or another. My guest is Kurt Eichenwald. His latest book, 500 Days, Secrets and Lies and the Terror Wars, published by Touchstone. Mr. Eichenwald wrote for the New York Times for more than 20 years. He is a two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism, finalist for the Pulitzer in 2000 and 2002, and the author of three New York Times best-selling books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. In what areas do you say the Bush administration overstepped its constitutional authority in the wake of the attacks? There was wiretapping of phones of U.S. citizens. Was that almost immediate?
It came fairly quickly. And, you know, one of the things about the nature of how that system worked, it's really not what people have thought it was. You know, I mean, if you picked up your phone and called your grandmother, you're not going to have, you know, Dick Cheney on the other end of the line listening. What you had is, and I mentioned bad numbers earlier on, if there was a call from a bad number that went into the United States, that call would get picked up. And that call would be listened to, with the idea being you know, if somebody associated with Al-Qaeda is calling somebody in the United States or vice versa, we want to know what's going on.
Well, that's reasonable.
Yeah, but it was very reasonable.
Was it legal? Were there ways of dealing with it that were circumvented?
It actually was legal, given the structure of how they did it. It was, you know, even folks at the NSA were saying this is really dicey. Because there was also another element to it, which I talk about in 500 Days, which is the collection of broad-scale data about Americans. I mean, it was not simply let's, you know, go off of this one number. This broad-scale data was used to create behavioral models, which could then pop, and you would see, you know, ways that terrorists behave would show up.
Are we still pursuing the same approaches today?
Yes. And I mean, some of the things have been undone. There were, you know, the constitutional questions began to override other considerations. The data gathering issue was particularly important.
And there are people within the Bush administration who were arguing against some of these approaches. Many of them just wound up leaving.
Right. And I mean, and again, it gets down to it's not a simple question. It's not as if the law was absolutely clear. I mean, the president signed off on it. It went to, went through this entire procedure where, you know, people had to say, yes, it's legal. It went to the intelligence committees in Congress. And so, you know, it's a very uncomfortable scenario, and they all knew it was uncomfortable. But the legal side of it was, you know, it was on the edge, if not over. But they wanted to, they thought they needed to do it, and was a very good argument that they did.
What did you discover about the Bush administration's knowledge of interrogation techniques that were being employed?
The interrogation techniques, you know, depending on where you want to come down, they're enhanced interrogation techniques or torture. I think if anybody else did them, we'd call them torture, and without any hesitation. The worst thing about those, before we get to the morality, before we get to should we have done it, the worst thing about those was that there was this huge amount of data. Reports within the CIA saying not only does this stuff not work, it's counterproductive. And they had some gentlemen come in as consultants who didn't know Al-Qaeda, didn't know the Middle East, didn't know terrorists, didn't know interrogation techniques, and they were putting themselves forward as people who knew all about this, and they said, here's the way to do it. And they designed this whole system. And it was, you know, part of it around the Al-Qaeda training manual I mentioned earlier. And later, the CIA, in its own report in 2004, said, we can't say whether any of this stuff worked. What we can say is the people we were consulting were not qualified to give these opinions.
Well, Dick Cheney and others have argued that they worked with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and that we got valuable information from him as a result of the interrogation techniques that were employed.
The second half of that statement is correct. We did get very important information from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. The first part of that question is, who knows? The CIA doesn't know. And in that report I was mentioning, what they said was, yes, we did these aggressive interrogation techniques, and yes, we got information, but we have no idea if those two things are connected. And it's also, you have to understand the nature of, you know, there's this sort of fantasy that what happens is the waterboarding takes place, which is horrible, by the way. I mean, I give a very graphic description of what waterboarding actually is.
Christopher Hitchens actually put himself through it and changed his mind about the safety of waterboarding.
I wanted to put myself through it, and I got ruled as not being healthy enough to do it, which in and of itself should tell you something. I'm not sure if it's about me or about that. But, you know, what you had with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in particular was, you know, he wasn't just, you know, giving up all these tons of information. What he was doing was giving bits and pieces of information by people who were essentially tricking him, you know, old-fashioned interrogation techniques. And because of that, they would get bits and pieces. Some of the bits and pieces he provided helped the administration bring down the largest al-Qaeda affiliate, which was in Southeast Asia.
Now, you also cover the anthrax scare. We don't have time to go into that. But what do we come away from the way that was handled with?
There's a lot of controversy. The fellow that the FBI said did it was a fellow named Bruce Ivins, who was a government anthrax specialist. And a lot of people say, no, couldn't have been, wasn't him. I've gone through all the evidence, and there's a lot of it. And if Bruce Ivins didn't do it, it's the most astonishing series of coincidences in history.
What made you decide to just do this on 500 days, roughly a year and a half after September 11th? Could it have been 2 years? Could it have...
The original idea for me was to do 8 years, was to do the entirety of the Bush administration and, you know, in terms of counterterrorism. And there are lots of people out there who sat through very long interviews and none of it got used.
There's another book in the works.
I think I'm done with that one. But what happened, the more I worked on it, the more I realized that everything after the first 18 months was reaction. And, you know, the day we went into Iraq, that was the final big decision. And so when I looked at it, it's like, you know, really what needs to be explored is these 500 days, because that set the path. That set the path for everything we're dealing with now. And, you know, people needed to understand how we got where we are much more than they needed to understand how we reacted to it later.
And the 500 days led to a pretty thick book, over 500 pages. So.
One page a day.
500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. It's published by Touchstone. Thank you so much, Kurt Eichenwald, for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me.